Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage,
how things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook. We're departing from our usual format this week. We won't have an Echoes, Patterns, and Profiles, but instead a series combining elements of all three. We'll be talking about the history, influence, and future of the Native Claims Act from the point of view of a political scientist. General Macbeth of the University of Alaska sees the birth of ANCSA as a political movement. But first, though, I asked him to tell us what the Act says.
Sure. The Act, as I see it, has three major sections, or components, rather. First, it makes a provision for land, both for extinguishing land claims of Alaska Natives and for providing land to Natives in some rough proportion to the lands lost. Second, it makes a provision for money, monetary settlements to Alaska Natives. And this settlement is in actually two forms. One is a direct cash grant payable over a number of years from the United States Treasury amounting to $462 million. The second aspect is a $500 million payment to Natives up through 1991 as a 2% charge assessed on oil revenues in the state of Alaska. This third provision of the Act is a managerial provision. It suggests that the Act will be administered through 12 regional corporations in the state of Alaska and one out-of-state corporation for natives not resident in the state of Alaska. And this, to me as a political scientist, is one of the most interesting aspects of the Act.
To me, too, and maybe we could talk about the concept.
Well, to most natives in 1971 and still to some extent today, the corporation concept is a new concept. In fact, the word corporation is not translatable into many of the Alaska Native languages. And so it was a difficult time then for early leaders of Native corporations and white consultants to explain exactly what this thing meant to the people who were involved in it. We could look at it, draw parallels, and suggest that it is simply one way of converting into American legalese, or American language of the law, the tribal entities of Alaska Natives. And it's difficult. The translation is difficult, and it's by no means complete. And it's something that has given lawyers millions of dollars worth of money.
What I'm wondering now is how that the idea of corporation got into the Act. Whose idea was it?
Well, it's been traced to several sources. I think the most believable is Joe Fitzgerald, who was an acting director of the Federal Field Committee, drawing up the Field Committee's report, Alaska Natives in the Land, who thought that the corporation would be a good vehicle to use in controlling the proceeds from the settlement. So other Native leaders quickly agreed with his idea. Now, the question was that in 1971 and prior to that, when the first legislative attempts were made in 1967, to decide exactly how the settlement would proceed, Natives definitely did not want the Act administered through the Bureau of Indian Affairs or through the Federal Interior Department because of the past history of these agencies with Natives. Nor did they want the Act administered through some other new agency of the federal government or an agency of the Alaska state government. On the part of senators and congressmen, there was considerable resistance toward giving money to existing Native organizations and structures. There was a question about the accountability of these. They were things that, with which senators and congressmen were simply not at all familiar. And there was a resistance on the part of the state government in giving proceeds to the new statewide organization, the Alaska Federation of Natives. Not only was it untried, but it was felt that giving money and managerial authority to one organization in the state would create a very large state within the state.
Mm-hmm.
So that then the corporation concept, based on regional Native groups, seemed a good way to go about it. That is, taking a pre-existing political, social organization, the Native Association, and making of it an economic structure, was thought to be the best way of distributing the proceeds and managing change and growth within Alaska Native regions.
Okay, were there then 12 existing Native associations at the time the Act was?
Well, yes, more or less. In other words, there are some smaller regional corporations, Otna is a case in point, Chugach, which could have been placed with larger regional corporations or regional organizations, but which were different in geography or in ethnicity, representing a different tribal group. Similarly, we could talk, for instance, about the ones I'm very familiar with are ASRC and NANA Regional Corporation. Both represent Inupiaq Eskimos. There could then be one large corporation representing all of the north of Alaska. But there are differences between the Kotzebue area Eskimos and the Barrow area Eskimos. They've been administered by different federal agencies. They have different patterns of growth and organization in towns and communities, even though they have also cooperated over the years. So then it made sense that there be two and not just one regional organization there. But I think that what produced the 12 regional corporations is the period of organization preceding that, period of organization that began in the first part of the 1960s and really took off and exploded in 1965.
Which we can call then kind of the claims, Native lands claim movement, like you might call the civil rights movement of the 60s.
Yes. It is a movement. I think it's important to understand that. It's not just a piece of legislation. It is a movement that started some time ago that perhaps reached one climax in the Claims Settlement Act itself, but which is not yet completely over.
Let's take it from the beginning, and we'll see where it's going.
Well, I think that, of course, the beginning in a case like this is very hard to trace. Some would put the beginning with the arrival of white people or non-natives in Alaska itself. I would start with statehood. Statehood made a provision for the lands that Alaskans can use through the grant of 103.5 million acres to the state of Alaska. It made no provision for natives, nor did it provide for the settlement of aboriginal claims in the state. Because the feeling of those at the Statehood Convention was that these were matters that the state itself couldn't decide. These were questions pertaining to federal lands that Congress or the courts would have to decide. Well, however, statehood did provide that there would be state lands and state selection of lands, and it was state selection of lands that started off the claim settlement movement in the state, because as the state moved very aggressively in the early 60s to find those lands with greatest mineral-bearing potential, it ran straight against native individuals who saw lands on which they had formerly hunted and fished and picked berries become the subject of interest of state land officers. So these factors then led to the organization of groups of natives. And we can then look at the organization of NANA in 65, late 65 and 66, the organization of the Arctic Slope Native Association, and the giving new life to organizations of natives developed earlier, the Athabascan Indians in the interior, Cook Inlet Association, Anchorage area natives and the like.
The unifying factor, as I see it all throughout this, is land.
Well, I think most definitely the land is at the center. Land is the motivating factor. It is what gives dynamism to the movement. The thread, the land can be seen from beginning to end in it.
I'm wondering is it land more than money, or is it just that land is money? I mean, is it the land first or the money that motivates?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think personally that land motivates more than money, but it depends on the region. For instance, in the southeast, the Tlingits and Haidas had filed with the Indian Claims Commission. They had made a settlement so that so far as their land claims were concerned, they were resolved. And there was nothing then further that they could do or that they could claim. To involve the Tlingit Haidas, who are an extremely important part of the Alaska Native community, means adding something in addition to land. However, for the North Slope Natives, that had participated in no earlier land claim settlement, land was the issue. Money was much less important to them. Now, it was also quite clear that a settlement in land alone would be, so far as Natives were concerned, almost a useless settlement. There would be no way for them to take advantage of the land to which they were given full fee simple title. There had to be money in order to ease the transition into modern ownership or the concept of modern ownership. Mm-hmm. So I guess my answer to that question has not been a very clear one, but altogether I would say that Natives ranged in their attitudes toward the land issue. To some it was the only thing of concern. And here I would say the North Slope Natives took the leading position. To others, land was a much less important concern. Here I would say that Southeastern Natives perhaps felt this way. Most of the Natives in the state, however, tended to range toward the North Slope position on land. They insisted on some land as part of the settlement.
Jerry Macbeth of the University of Alaska. On our next program, we'll discuss the politics of Native leadership and the formation of Native claims legislation. For Chinook, I'm Paula Schiller. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage, how things are and how they got that way. Chinook Patterns is information,
issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This is Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller with Jerry Macbeth of the University of Alaska. And here's the second part of our discussion of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act from the point of view of a political scientist. There is an aphorism that says those who lead revolutions rarely stay in power, that brilliant leaders are not always good administrators. But when it comes to the leaders in the Native Claims Movement in Alaska, the rule may not hold true.
There are some Natives leaders who have commented about the most vibrant and alive of the early Native leaders, that these are men who are not the best leaders of Native corporations today, that what's needed is a different kind of leader personality. I'm not so sure I agree with that, because in many cases they haven't had the opportunity, the early land claims leaders, to control organizations based on the settlement.
Well, what the movement then in the 60s did, though, was produce some of these leaders that were revolutionary, that were able to get their lobbying across and their views across. And these would have had to been leaders that were kind of bridging an old and new world, I would guess. They would have to. Where did they come from, and who are they? Maybe not by name, but what?
They're fairly well known by name, the land claims leaders. Emil Nani, the first president at Bay of N, and Athabascan, who was also a former head of the Cook Inlet Native Corporation. Willie Hensley, leader of Northwest Arctic Native Association. Charlie Edwardson of the Arctic Slope, and Eben Hobson. Byron Malott. These, it seems to me, are young, or were at the time in the 1960s, leaders, all of whom were under 40, mm-hmm. were relatively well-educated, who traveled throughout the state, were familiar with, as familiar as most white people were, with corporations and with the importance in politics of being able to organize a group and present group demands to legislators and other representative bodies. You're asking, Albert, a more difficult question. You're asking the extent to which these new leaders bridged an old and a new society, as though there were a new society there. I'm not so sure there was.
Well,
and I don't know exactly the shape of the old society. It's a transitional one,
mm-hmm.
and that's a nice fuzzy label that we can use to apply to something that we personally perhaps haven't studied or don't know about very much. But it does seem that these were leaders who worked very well in white society of the 1960s and early 1970s, but who knew where power was within their community and what people in their community thought and wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, they were then a very effective group of leaders, in my opinion.
What I'm getting at with that is something that I found in some of your papers. You've said that the Tundra Times editorialized on the new breed of Native leadership, which was changing the face of rural and Native Alaska. And you talk about the ways that the leaders of the land claims movement were different from traditional leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very, very nice passage and very, very concise. Do you perhaps want to take a look at it? And
well, no, I wrote this, you know, a few months ago, and so I may have changed my mind.
Can I read it?
But, well, here I've said that I've talked about the ways in which leaders of the land claims movement were different from traditional leaders, and I've said that first they were younger men, which made the movement distinctive in the development of Alaska Natives as communities. They were all under 40 years old, at least Hensley, Malott, Edwardson, and Nottie were. Second, they differed in education. Most of them had completed high school training, contributing to their acculturation to white society. Third, they were more knowledgeable about politics and law and more willing to experiment with different kinds of political tactics. And they were politically assertive, not passive. Fourth, the new leaders were more likely to have a statewide orientation. By this we mean they were less tied to their village of origin. They were more experienced in the various Alaska communities, having either traveled extensively as part of their educational training or participated in anti-poverty programs in other areas than their own. Finally, in attitude, they responded to the tempos of the 60s rather than to those of the 40s. They were intent on dealing with administrators and politicians as equals, not merely as clients of administrative agencies. Now, this is something, again, you know, that's sort of set in concrete. And when we talk with natives themselves, they may have, and some of them, I'm sure, do have different perceptions of leaders, land claim leaders. I'm a social scientist. I put mm-hmm. people into categories rather easily, but we want to be careful of not, you know, putting people into boxes that don't always correspond with reality. So there were then some traditional leaders who played important roles in the land claims movement. They did so, however, as symbols of the traditional culture which natives were trying to preserve. Now, again, this is my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Chief Isaacs of Tanna Cross, for instance, is somebody who was presented as a representative of a form of life that was in danger of dying, lest there be a settlement adequate for the needs of those people. The newer leaders, however, were able to take advantage of traditional forms of leadership and to use them in the most appropriate way while knowing very well and understanding the politics of protest of the American 60s and the politics of organization. These, I think, they mastered. And that's what contributed toward the land claims settlement. It is then very hard to imagine a group of traditional leaders forming an alliance with the highly sophisticated interests of oil, of national conservation groups, of even state politics and state government. But the younger leaders did this and did it well.
Now, as you said, that the movement leaders, the revolutionary leaders, the movers of a movement may or may not necessarily be the best people to then manage the results of their labors. That brings us to the corporations, the effects of having to, for somebody, to have to understand business, how to handle money, how to meet payrolls and things like that. How is that kept in the hands of natives?
Well, I somehow feel it hasn't been kept in the hands of natives at all.
There was some attempt, wasn't there? Wasn't there in the act to make sure that the control remained with?
Yes, there were attempts, good faith attempts, I think. But let's look at the attempts and look at some of the results. What some allege have been the results. First, members of corporations have to be natives, having at least 1/4 native ancestry. And members of corporations must be those who were alive at the time the bill was passed in December 1971. That the corporation then represents these, all these individuals, each of whom was given 100 shares of stock in its corporation. Members of the members or shareholders form a board of directors, all of whom must be members of the corporation and thus must be natives. The board of directors then appoints or selects its management team, its executive officers, in particular its executive vice president, the individual who is the chief agent for keeping the corporation alive and meeting its payrolls. And it's at this point that some allege that control, native control of the corporation has been lost, because in many cases, natives selected as executive vice presidents or key executive officers, individuals with whom they'd worked previously who were not natives, and whose interests perhaps were not the same as those of the early land claims leaders or most of the people in native communities. And so there then has surfaced in a series of regional corporations shareholder battles between the managerial team and a young Turk team that would seek to oust a management officer and replace him with somebody who is more responsive to what it is felt are the genuine interests of that native corporation. So I think it can be said that not all native corporations are run in terms of native interests and values. But if we ask the more difficult question of exactly which ones are not and why are they not, then we're getting into the matter of determining what the interests of the regional corporation are.
That's rather difficult to say. Yeah, I don't think we should. It's not, certainly not the two of us can. What I'm wondering, though, is that makes an awful, or creates a demand for managerial leaders, for native people that can, you know, run corporations, and they can't all have been ready for that. There just can't be that many in a population as small as Alaskans ready to take on those responsibilities.
Well, I think that's heading toward putting it in the right perspective. We're talking about a small group of people.
Uh-huh.
It is not that there are too few natives who are good managers, but that there are only 60,000 resident Alaska natives. And in any community of 60,000, you're likely to find only a few who are good managers. So that is a problem. And this is a problem that results from the way the act was drafted. But again, had there been one corporation, there would have been fewer problems of this nature, but more problems of a different kind.
Jerry Macbeth of the University of Alaska Political Science Department. In the final segment of this series on ANCSA, we'll take up some of the loose ends and discuss the problems in the Act itself and possible changes. For Chinook, I'm Paula Schiller. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.